give up on us. Give up in us.
Welcome to the Living with Heart podcast with Dr. Chip Dodd. Good morning, Dr. Chip Dodd.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Good to see you. And I really want to thank you for doing this. I love doing this.
I love doing this too.
This is important. Very, very important.
You know what I'm glad about this morning?
What?
That there is not construction across the street this morning. Yeah. We've heard no roosters at this point.
Yeah. And, you know, I started thinking about it. Sonia said the rooster is just not okay and embarrassing.
She said that?
Yeah, like just the rooster's got to go. I mean.
But what are your options? It's not, you can't kill it.
No. There. In fact, my sister sent me a notice. There's a group called Gentle Farm. Okay. And they come and get animals that aren't desired in certain places and take them to their place. And two of our friends just last week, a guy got a box from his car and they chased this rooster all over the parking lot trying to catch it. One of them actually caught it and it slipped out of
Really? I didn't know
hands.
This.
So, I mean, it's like something from a movie now.
The rooster saga continues.
Extremely Southern.
The funniest part to me last week, I won't say who it is, but I got tagged on Twitter by somebody that I did not know was listening to the podcast who said, is this... Okay, so I'm trying to be confidential in terms of names here. We need to be confidential. But somebody who has seen you posted about this rooster.
Yeah.
I was like, is that our rooster?
Yeah, you said.
And so somebody else tagged me to say, is that the rooster I heard about in the podcast?
Yeah.
And it was the rooster from the podcast.
Yeah. And it sits on the ledge of a window and sort of pecks on the glass and crows, waiting for whoever this person is feeding the rooster. It goes to the feeding spot and like says, cock-a-doodle-doo, come feed me. So
the most important takeaway from that is go Gamecocks. So,
which leads us actually, that's really actually great for you to say, because this actually does lead us into the podcast. We're doing touch.
Right. We're talking about the need for touch.
Yes. And
I cannot wait to see how you're going to
connect the rooster really important. It's
okay.
Really clear.
Go for it. I feel like I'm about to watch like the circus of a guy like walk the tightrope, you know, and be like, how in the world are you going to cross?
So
you have the bridge of the rooster and you have the bridge of the need of touch. And now you have a tightrope that I'm going to watch you walk from
Absolutely.
One to the other.
And so the reference point was go Gamecocks, and Gamecocks are the University of South Carolina.
Right. Of which I'm a proud alumnus. Right.
Like Roll Tide.
Yeah.
Is an elephant. I don't understand Roll Tide.
Yeah, I don't understand that either.
That's, you know. Anyway, so in terms of touch, I want us to talk about good touch.
Right.
Healthy touch. And out of that recognition of good touch and healthy touch, we will recognize its counterfeit. And from what I understand, there's an old story about the Canadian Mounties. They did not, they were, one of their jobs was to recognize counterfeit money, fake money. And they didn't recognize counterfeit money by studying all the ways that it can be counterfeited. They studied the real article, and they knew the real article so deeply and so clearly that counterfeit money was easily recognizable.
Hmm.
So I want us to talk good touch, healthy touch, feeding touch in this podcast. And then out of that, we will start to recognize counterfeit fairly easily.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting on the front end before we were talking. You said how sick our society is that, you know, where our mind goes when we hear the word touch is immediately like, oh, this is going to be like an awful, really hard conversation to have. That was kind of like that's what I felt bringing in here.
Yeah, the fear.
Like, oh, we're going to talk about everything that's bad. We're not going to talk, almost like there's no space to talk about the healthy expression
Absolutely.
Of touch.
The association touch is associated so tragically probably always has been, but now more pronounced and more twisted than ever before. It's associated with sex and associated with abuse.
Right.
And so sex abuse. And it is so tragically, because we're so removed from what healthy touch is and how to communicate related to healthy touch and how to have boundaries related to recognizing its abuse, that we can really oftentimes not have the conversation about touch with having to slip into the sickness, which actually prevents in some ways the goodness of touch being pronounced in a way that actually feeds the heart, feeds the soul, feeds the mind, and feeds security, mm-hmm. feeds safety, feeds care, which is what really touch is about in its right. good form.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like people have tragically many justifiable reasons to even see, you know, the topic is touch and be like, you know, immediately past traumatic experiences to them or somebody yes. they love is immediately conjured. But yes. I think our particular emphasis in this is to say there's a real lack of conversation about what does the healthy expression of this mm-hmm. look like. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be the priority for our conversation.
Yeah. And touch the thing is, a touch is one of the needs that we need to be touched. And touch has a great deal to do with thriving. We'll talk about, you know, babies even mm-hmm. and failure to thrive syndrome. But touch is a language that doesn't necessarily have a voice.
Right.
And so therefore it's a language that doesn't have a voice. So therefore it can be abused because nothing necessarily, something that doesn't always get said.
Hmm.
So therefore communication with it can be unclear, but the unclear means questionable.
Yeah.
And so we're going to get to today's podcast, the importance of being able to ask questions.
Right.
Questions have everything to do with keeping touch healthy.
Okay.
But let's go back to let me do two things. One is let me just touch base on what unless you want to read from the touch chapter, unless you have a section right there that says what touch is or something. Otherwise, I'll go to its importance.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot from this chapter that I wanted to focus on. I mean, I think from the very beginning, just a few highlights to maybe mm-hmm. that since you reference it, you know, you say that the need, this is from Needs of the Heart, chapter 5, chapter on touch. I'm on page 27. The need for touch is one of the deepest forms of fulfillment that we have. And it can also be one of the most abused needs that we possess. Mm-hmm. A child will literally not develop physically according to developmental norms without being touched. And emotional growth and trust are connected to touch if we are touched well. And, you know, per the conversation we had earlier in prior podcasts, you say your need for belonging and mattering is fed through brief moments of appropriate, caring touch.
Yeah. And touch is so much bigger and far beyond what we think of in terms of hands or, you know, skin. It's not just reaching across that space between one person to another and extending ourselves. It is permission to extend ourselves, though, with our eyes, with our voices, with our giving, with our mm-hmm. sharing, with our offering. And so all of those things, offering, sharing, all those things are connections. But ultimately, touch is so vital that we cannot truly grow without it.
Yeah.
In terms of just infancy, the failure to thrive syndrome, one of the things that was confirmed during a time in Eastern Europe, the Romanian orphanages back, I think this is really 30 years ago now, one of the things the sociologists continue to confirm that we already knew was that when a human being is custodially cared for, which means treated like a thing, fed, watered, bedded down, and then go away, come back and do the same yeah. thing, wash, rinse, repeat, that the babies in these orphanages that the caregivers did not have enough time to attend to, they were fed, watered, clothed. In other words, they're quote, what we usually think of as needs were being met,
right,
which is physical. And some of these children were 5 years old and had the bodies of two-year-olds.
Right.
They did not develop. Going back to the APGAR, you know, when we talked about mm-hmm. earlier that when a child comes into life, it's they cry out feelings, they reach out needs, and they crave connection.
Right.
And so craving for connection, craving fulfillment. And we talked about how that craving for fulfillment is met through an oxytocin bond, a sense of being fully connected, when infant has the touch, holding, caring for, really literally communication without words of being held. Mm-hmm. And in that being held, that child is not biologically getting fed with milk. That child is emotionally and spiritually and truly a heart being fed with touch.
Right.
So the idea of being held. And we also know that in that being held during that moment, and I know it's science that says it, but it's really an emotional and spiritual experience. The baby is literally being turned on. It's a plug that has met an outlet. The electricity, the awakening of this little human being to safety and care through touch. So that's the initial importance of it. And without it, we don't thrive emotionally and spiritually and ultimately physically.
Yeah, I think that's a really great place to start in terms of you were naming, regardless of diversity of worldview, you were naming an objective reality that anybody in science would recognize in terms of the very tragic illustration that if a child is not touched and interacted with tremendous regularity, there are significant developmental delays as a consequence. And what's interesting to me, as you were saying that, the question I was thinking in my head was, even though we recognize that as a society, I mean, that's largely a unanimous view, is why do we assume that that stops at a certain age?
Brilliant question. You know, look at...
Like, I tend to think... Sorry to cut you off, but just... Here's what I tend to instinctually think, because I recognize that. I tend to think, that's probably because an infant is nonverbal. Consequently, that's the way that they experience relationship. But at two, for example, that is... changes and touch isn't all that important anymore without much thoughtfulness and just functioning out of pure instinctiveness. I think that's the way a lot of people.
Oh gosh. Yes. Think. Oh, I thought you were going like it. Yes. No, it's a 2-year-old will actually in their beginning of verbal expression will go, hold me, or they'll cling, or they're, you know, you're walking, you think they're just tired of walking, but they're also tired of not being held when they say, oh, they reach up.
I'm thinking of my oldest, Hannah. She would say, she'd go, hold you me. Yeah. That's what she would say.
Yes.
Just all the time.
Yes. And they're saying need for touch, need for safety, need for care, need for being held, need for electricity, mm-hmm. need for like these Tesla vehicles, so the need for reboot kind of thing. But you know, you said we'll talk a lot about this, that one of the basic tenets related to our needs is that our needs never stop from birth to death.
Right.
As we were born, so shall we remain, and we're created to mature developmentally.
Right.
Which means better at accurately getting our needs met and do so in a way that's compassionate, which means recognize that everybody has them. In other words, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. That's what maturity is. It doesn't mean you no longer have needs. It means you're able to care about others and their needs too.
Right.
Right. So that's important. But when we get to the need for attention, and we'll touch on it in just a moment, I think it's a great example that very often, by the time you're 8 years old, you start to become toxically ashamed of a need for attention. In fact, it becomes, that question becomes an insult and a warning. Like, oh, do you need some attention? Mm. Oh, you're 12 years old. Oh, so you need attention? You're a neurosurgeon and you've done wonderful work that day and need attention? Yes, because that wonderful work needs to be celebrated. That wonderful work needs to be accommodated. Like, I'm exhausted. Mm-hmm. That I need to be tended to, yeah. Right? I need to be cared about. I need to be recognized. I need to be touched by care.
Yeah.
So at a certain age, we start in our shame saying, I no longer need attention. Mm. And that's one of the tragedies. Once we're born, the tragedy is we start moving farther and farther away from how we're made.
Yeah.
And instead of maturing, we go into dormancy, suppression, repression, and that's where it leads to tremendous amounts of dysfunction, unhealth, impairments, which is going to happen anyway, but it doesn't have to happen as much as it does.
Right.
Right. So what's amazing is the more you serve parents, the more you give pastors, the more you offer your expertise to a world in need, physicians, the more attention you need. Mm. So what we think of, you reach a certain level and you, as a professional, you shouldn't need right. something that you actually need more of than a four-year-old. Mm. Okay. So parents, mama, daddies, you're caring for a child all day long. Just one. They are a need bucket, mm-hmm. right? And they're taking from the resources that the other person has.
Right.
By the end of the day, the person with the resources is going to be running low. So what do they do to get attention so they can keep tending to the other?
Yeah.
So it's amazing. I love that you brought that up, because life begins to be walking away from how we're made.
Right.
Instead of taking how we're made everywhere we go and learning how to live that person with other people and God. Mm. So great question.
So you were saying earlier there was two places you wanted to go.
Yeah, we got to get that rooster. We're going to do the rooster. So I hope that people will listen till we get to the rooster.
Oh, yeah. Well, the rooster.
You already forgot. Because, like, what rooster?
Well, the rooster. Yeah, it was funny. The rooster's crowing again.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's being picked up. Did you hear it?
No, I didn't even.
Oh, yeah.
I
was so that's what I thought that's what you were referencing.
No, the
rooster's.
I didn't.
Oh, okay.
And what was the rooster question? Can you remember?
What were we talking about? Okay, you were saying
Gamecocks.
Okay.
Let's get to
so
that
you
right
said
now.
You said right that now. There yeah. was that was a good
that's a good segue.
Segue. I don't know if you've proven how is it a segue into a conversation
yeah.
about healthy.
Yeah, let's see
healthy
you pull
touch.
This one off.
Yeah,
Chip.
I'm
okay.
still waiting.
Well, look, let's talk the good touch, healthy touch. I was 14 years old, and this story actually has a longevity connected to it that is significant in terms of my high school reunion that was about 6 years ago. We're moving towards 50 years out of high school, right? 14 years old, I'm a freshman in high school. So we're talking 52 years ago. I'm telling a story 52 years old as if it happened yesterday. The power of touch, okay? And it's goodness. But also we'll recognize in that the power of its not wanting to remember because when it's bad, okay? So I'm 14 years old. There were, it's time for going out from eighth grade into high school football. And I'm going to a school, there are 3,000 students at this one high school before we split into so many other high schools. One of the top programs in the state, it's recognized, it was legendary. But you had to prove yourself worthy to get into the varsity program. So they had a freshman football team, and nobody gets cut. You just get run off. The job of the coaches is to see if you, quote, have what it takes to stay. You can be the worst athlete in the world, but if you stay, you're in. Mm-hmm. If you, it doesn't matter how gifted or talented you are. If you can't endure it, you're out. Mm-hmm. I mean, just real simple equation, and that's ugly actually. But anyway, so I went out for football thinking, you know, I really need to do this. I've really got to do this. I've got to prove myself, because the 2 years before I'd gone out for football in the seventh grade and I quit. And I was 2 weeks delayed. They had already been practicing a couple of weeks, and I just suddenly said, well, I'm going to go play football. And my mother dropped me off. And I ran over to the football field. I said, I want to play football. And it's like, well, all of a sudden I'm, you know, I've got some cleats, I'm working out, and like, what, I can't do this. And I left, and to my chagrin, to my shame, and to really disturbed, I think it really, my father didn't know what to do with me in terms of, he was really upset.
This is when you were in seventh
grade. Seventh grade. I mean, yeah. I'm a 12.
This is the first time.
Yeah, this is the first time.
So now you're trying it again.
Now I'm trying it again. And so it's really important. So there were 88 kids that went out. And after 2 weeks, there were 14 of us left. And and then, like I say, you don't get cut. You just get run off. I mean, if you can stay, you can, and talk about all the different ways of, you know, threatening, challenging, not allowed to drink. This was a time, honestly, we were not allowed to drink water. He brought a bag of ice out, threw it on the ground, cut the bag open. Anybody want to drink? And we already knew at that time, don't touch it or you will die. Because if you touch the ice or you want water, you're going to run more. Yeah. So better die thirsty. Be run to death. I mean, it was that kind of catch 22.
That's what I was going to ask, because I mean, I know that was a real thing. I think there's Bear Bryant stories about that. Like when he was at Texas A&M, you know, he was at A&M before Alabama.
Oh, yeah.
And there was the whole mindset that withholding water makes you stronger, more resilient.
Yes. And any of you people listening who remember the Titans, there was that sort of mentality even then. So drinking water is actually a new phenomenon.
That's probably
in the world of sports.
There's probably a great parable in that in itself of like rejecting the way we were made and what happened. I mean, people literally. Yes. I mean, the reason that changes because people died. Yes. Like they actually died
overcoming
from that mindset.
Yeah, and let's also face that commercialism had a great deal to do with the drinking water called Gatorade.
I mean, right.
Like electrolytes. All you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Which is in anyway. So there were 14 of us, and I think we ended up getting down to 11 at one point. Okay.
Did the coach know that if he went below 11, he would not have enough people to field the team?
He communicated that he simply did not care.
Okay.
I mean,
preparing to play. At least your playing time was going to be extensive if you made the team.
I'm going to be honest with you. The night that we had 12 guys, there was both coaches. One of the coach's sons was managing the team because he was a single parent and had to take care of his kid all the time. And I'm over on the sidelines with him. I played, everybody needed a break that was on the line. So, I mean, I was just attempting to make the team.
That is,
because it wasn't about football to me. It was about being loved or not.
Okay.
Like, if I didn't stay, I was lost.
Right.
And I want you to know that, believe it or not, there were some kids that did not stay. And it was that big a deal during that time at that place that they didn't stay. I mean, it affected their lives. So it's crazy.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think there were 13 of us or 14 total. There's a guy I know. I'll end with a story with the photograph of a guy who has the photograph from our annual. But we lost to a local team that was in our county. First time that this team had ever lost to these people. And we were the first weak bunch that he had ever coached. And this coach had actually taken a track pistol out onto the field. One of the kids had broken his leg 3 years before. He used to talk about the old core and how tough they were. And, you know, and a guy had broken his leg named Ricky. And the coach went in and got a gun and pointed it at his head and pulled the trigger and shot him with a track pistol. And one of the things I did, I held up an aluminum bat during a lightning storm to show that I, you know, really wanted to be on the team. So it was that kind of, this sounds insane, doesn't it?
Well, you're going to say, almost what?
Insane?
Well, I was going to say absolutely insane.
Okay, exactly.
Yes, not almost.
It's amazing, even reflecting back on our other podcasts, the need to belong and the need to matter is very powerful.
Yeah.
And I needed to belong and I needed to matter very badly.
I mean, this is basic psychology underneath, like hazing.
Yeah.
Like Greek culture and I mean all that.
Yeah. And so we lost the game. The coach that night said, you better bring your lunches tomorrow because practice is going to be forever and on and on. So we come scared, and it is as bad as we could imagine. And then after practice, we had to run a 400, which was called the 440. We had to run a 400 in under a minute and 10 seconds after practice, or else you had to do it again. And this was the first time that we, this was now after this practice, we're doing our 400s. This was for the first time. And I did something that I had honestly never done in my life. I pulled the cheat button because I was desperate. Like, I knew I was done. So the first group there, like I say, they're 13 of us. The first group of three runs the 400. All right. I know that I'm done. I said in my head, in my heart, I can't do this. It's over. I'm finished. And I knew that I was facing darkness, but the darkness was on some level more attractive than facing, I can't go any farther. Like, I was truly done, defeated. And I had enough desperation. This is sick and brilliant too, but I had enough desperation that I thought I could get away with at least one of them not doing it. So I went over to the pack of three after they finished and bent over and started fake breathing.
Like you would run with them.
I literally, I pulled an acting job off. So I got out of the first one. Right?
Oh, wow.
I literally got out of it by hanging with the guys that had already run it.
Can't believe those guys didn't rat you out.
Oh, it
okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So there was enough of self-preservation and enough non-recognition. Everybody was just surviving that when the second one came, I thought, well, it's over. I can't go hide anymore. And I was a kid at the time. My conscience was so severe that I really had rarely, if ever, cheated. You know, I didn't copy from anybody's test. In fact, if I saw somebody's answer on a test, oh, crap, I saw that answer, and I would erase my own if it was the same. Like that, I mean, way over the board, overboard. And then there I was. It's over. And time to run. Mm. And I looked at the coach, the kind one. The other one had the timer at the end of the 400. I said, I can't do it. I said, I'm done. I can't do it. And there's a kid that in the fourth grade, we used to go to each other's houses and go to ball games together and so on. And I taught him how to hit a baseball. And we hadn't seen each other since fourth grade, went to different middle schools. And he heard me say, I can't do it. I'm quitting. And he said, don't do this. Don't quit. And I looked at him. His name was John Carter. And I said, I got to. And it's like we were back in the fourth grade again. Mm. Do you know? Like, I'm defeated. And then another kid starts screaming, you heard him. You heard him. He done. He had done. Like, get out of here. And so I'm just standing there. Pushed and pulled, darkness and light. And then I received a miracle of touch. What happened was that I was standing by the coach. I walked up and said, I looked him in the face. I said, I can't do it. Like, it's over for me. And Brian, you know, if anybody's out there grasp when something's desperate, it's like, it really may be. And it really is going to mean the difference between one way or another. I mean, it had that feel to it. I will be utterly a disappointment. I will be utterly unrecognizable. I will be banished. And disappointment really does mean, that's how come it's really vital that as much as possible, we never tell a child I'm disappointed in you or even other people for that matter, because it means that you no longer have an appointment. Disappointment means you don't have an appointment. You go to a restaurant and you have a reservation by birth, by being these parents' child. And you go to the maitre d' and you say, well, I have a reservation at 7. Maitre d', who's hired, looks at the list and says, your name's not on it. Well, like, but I had a reservation. So disappointment.
You don't have a place here.
You don't have a place here. Right. You no longer belong here, and you don't matter. Mm. And the coach used to say, mind over matter, boys. I don't mind, and you don't matter. So, I mean, that was the importance of him taking us away from our parents. When actually everybody on that team, I don't know if these guys would agree with it, but we look back at that photo, every single person on that team, black and white, was an orphan. Orphaned socially, orphaned specifically, orphaned emotionally, and every one of us on that team was secretly needing something that made us stay. It wasn't just love of the game. It wasn't just, I just can't wait to play football. It was trying to get somewhere else, trying to get away from somewhere too.
It didn't have a safe place. Nope. You know, that's where, as I know this isn't the point of the story, because I still haven't heard the part about the touch that brings all this.
Yeah.
But as you're talking, I'm thinking about like, oh, this is a really not just unhealthy, but dangerous situation. I don't feel like that's like me as the modern, you know, parent being soft or something like that. Like, I mean, literally the reason regulations like this change is because scenarios like this have led to children dying. And if somebody's in a healthy family system, their parent would be able to say, hey, like you can come home. It's safe for you to come home. You don't have to do this. This is actually not safe for you. I actually don't want you to be in an unhealthy situation. Yeah. You don't have to make the team in order to matter. You have a place with us, regardless if you're playing football or not playing football. But I think it's a really interesting observation that's really the continuation of the prior conversations we've had that, yeah, a functional orphan is like, well, if I don't belong in this crazy place, I don't belong anywhere. So it's worth holding up an aluminum bat for to, you know, belong and matter in some way.
Yeah. Oh, to be called names, insulted, knocked about, all that kind
of
stuff.
And to want it more on the other side of that. I mean, that's...
Yeah. And see, even... I didn't know it till later that in Navy SEALs, for example, and I'm not suggesting that 14-year-old freshman football teams, Navy SEALs, but the Navy SEALs, they do take a person to the limits of human perseverance and endurance. But the leaders of Navy SEALs do not want them to fail.
Yeah.
They want them to succeed. They want them to stay. And they're communicating, I want you to stay. Because we're investing in you being someone who can stay.
Right.
You know, not because of desperation, but because of desire. Right. Two different things.
Right.
So, yeah, this was not the Navy SEALs. This was not, I want you to stay.
Right.
It was more like, I dare you to stay, and I don't think you can, and I'm going to do everything I can to make you not.
Right.
So it had that feel. So what happened was that I was at that moment, and the coach did this most amazing thing. His name's Gale Blair. He passed on years and years ago. But I want his name to be remembered because he left a legacy in a person's heart called Chip. And I was done. I mean, I really want you to know I was done. I was a hospital patient at this point, and he was either going to be an ER doctor or not. And he looked at me, and the tone of his voice spoke into everything I was looking for in doing it in the first place. He said, yes, you can. But it wasn't like, yeah, you can do it. By God, you're going to do it. It was, you can do it. You can do it. It like almost said my name. Hey, Chip, you can do this. And then what he did was he reached out his hand and he patted me on the rib cage. And he said, you can do it. He patted me on the rib cage. And all I did was like, go do it. I just turned around and started running. And they timed me. And it was, it had to do it in a minute 10. I did it 2 minutes and something. It took all day long. I mean, I was like dying. I mean, just dehydrated. Now, after that, then I had to go. It said, Dodd, you go up there. You better run a 100-yard dash in 15 seconds, or you will be out here for the rest of your life. So I went up and did it and ran to 15 seconds, and then I got to go home. Like, ugh. And that moment, I was saved by a tone of voice that touched me. I was saved by a pat on the rib cage. That touched me. And that man left a legacy that is in my heart through that touch. And that's what makes life rememberable, is that we leave legacies based upon how we touch people's lives in the place that saves it, treasures it, or wishes to vomit it and forget it.
Mm.
So touch is that big a deal that we need to do it in healthy ways, which is through permission, through appropriate need, never taking advantage, but doing unto others as we would truly have them do unto us. But we've got to be sensitive to ourselves. That coach had to be sensitive enough to a young man, child, to say, hey, he needs my help. He needs my care. He needs my, he treated me like a truly like a daddy to a son. His tone of voice was, you can, I'm with you, I support you. And he patted me on the ribs. Appropriate place to pat somebody in male world.
That's so interesting. So you are bringing a memory, you were bringing to mind a similar memory for me that I have not really thought about. Can I share it?
Yes, please.
And it was something about you talking about Navy SEALs. Not that I was a Navy SEAL, but it's interesting. So I originally went to the Naval Academy, and they sent me to the Naval Academy is in Annapolis, but I spent my first year, I was supposed to spend my first year, it's something called NAPS, which is called the Naval Academy Prep School. And it's for kind of three different groups of people. It's up in Newport, Rhode Island. And it's for, it's the way they redshirt athletes, because you can't redshirt athletes at the military academies. I got in to play baseball. I didn't get in off my grades. They send people that are struggling academically, and then they send people who were enlisted who are trying to go through the academy. So it was an interesting conglomeration of people there. You know, you had Marines who had been in Iraq who were 19 years old, you know, who had seen some crazy stuff. And then you had guys like me, you know, that I was just going there because
out of high school
playing baseball, because it was kind of the way they redshirted and my grades needed to be better too. So when you go there, you do kind of their expression of boot camp. Boot camp, I think they called it military indoctrination was the language they used. So I started that. I'm 18 years old. You know, the point, and they kind of prep you on the front end to tell you the point of this is that it's a game that is meant for you to fail so that you can be broken down. Because a lot of times people who end up at the military academies, it's very hard to get in. And so people who go to the military academies are kind of big fish in small ponds, and they're trying to kill your independence so you can be able to function, you know, humbly and in the context of team. And so they are going to create mental and physical challenges for you to fail over and over again, because they're used to people coming in who have kind of won at most of the things they've done. So they would do things physically where, you know, they would have you do a seating position on a wall, and, you know, if you could do it for 2 minutes, the next time they're going to do it for 3 minutes. And if you could do it for 3 minutes, I mean, it's just going to go until you fail and they can yell at you and you accept it. You know, you don't make any excuses. You just accept it. And they wouldn't just do that physically, but they would do that emotionally as well, or intellectually, where they would ask you questions. Like, I remember being able to know the chain of command from myself, where I was enlisted, you know, the lowest of the low, to George W. Bush was the president at the time. And I could tell you the whole chain of command from myself to George W. Bush.
Wow.
And if you got that, you know, they're going to ask you a question like, what's George W. Bush's birthday? Okay, what's his wife's birthday? What's his daughter's birthday? You know, the point of it is to break you down. And even though on the front end, you know, intellectually, they've prepped you, you're like, okay, it's not personal. It's at least for me, impossible to be in that environment where you're constantly being yelled at and constantly being told you're a failure and not to be broken down by it. So that's the context of saying, I remember one Sunday, and everything is like this, the meals, going to the bathroom, waking up. I mean, it's just like, everything is like this. There's no reprieve from it. And I remember Sunday came after a week of this, and they said, you can go to church if you want to. And I was like, I wonder if they're not as mean there. Like for me, I wasn't a Christian yet. We didn't spend a whole lot of time around this stuff growing up. And they were like, you can go to the Catholic one or the Protestant one. And I was like, well, I don't know what Protestant is, but I know I'm not Catholic. All so right. I'll go to the other one.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's in the gym, you know, just like, and don't think like nice gym. Think like, you know, the high school with the, you know, the fluorescent lighting. And I mean, it's, and so I'm making my way over there to like, quote unquote, go to church. And at the door is one of my scariest drill sergeants. I mean, scary guy, you know, and I'm like getting ready to go in and terrified. You're just always terrified you're going to mess up and get yelled at and be punished and lose lunch.
They grabbed you. You thought you were going to church.
Exactly. I mean, I'm like, what is this test? What is this test? And, you know, you just, there's a whole thing about the way you're supposed to walk and the way you're supposed to have posture and the way you answer a question. And so you're kind of on guard, getting ready. He's at the door. And I don't even interact with him. I think he sees, you know, I'm very on guard for valid reason. And he puts his hand on my shoulder. I'm getting emotional thinking about it.
And it's something.
He puts his hand on my shoulder and he says, hey, for the next hour, you can rest here.
Wow.
And I mean, it was not a great church service. I don't remember a lot about it, but it was just like something about.
Sounds like the best one you'd ever been to.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just, it was that. That's all I remember about it. And it was just like, I can still picture it of him putting his hand on my shoulder. And you just, you know, it's just something like, oh, I can rest, you know, like it's safe.
And for those people who aren't here, it was because it's just me, you. You literally, you breathed, then you took your hand and put it over where your heart is with your fingers spread out. It's something it did. It touched, fed your heart. Like, I am now officially for 1 hour safe and cared about. I don't have to be hypervigilant. I'm in a place I'm made to be.
Right.
Which will refuel me to go take care of business in a world that is difficult and full of suffering that ultimately I need to address.
Right.
You know, I need to go care enough about to help. Yeah. Right. So that's, and Brian, how old is that story?
It was 20 years ago.
And you're
it'll be 21 years ago this fall.
Cause you're old.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy to think about that. I was 18. I'm 39.
Right.
No.
And I'm 66 and I'm talking about a 14-year-old. So, I mean, is touch powerful?
Oh yeah.
I mean, he put his hand on your shoulder, but he touched you in the way that you're made to be touched, that left a channel to receive.
Right.
That it was accurate and congruent. Do you know? And what?
Bingo. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, just another tangential thought as we've been talking is, you know, as I've said before, my kids are little right now. So 10, 6, 4, and then Ruthie will be 3, not this Sunday, but next Sunday. She's a St. Patrick's Day baby. And especially my 4 and my almost 3-year-old are very in that, like, hold me, hold me, hold me, hold me. I mean, it's like it you feel like crap saying it, but you're just like, can you just not need me to hold you right now? It's very overwhelming. Right. And a lot of times, it's funny, this past Sunday at church, a lot of times I'll have to carry both of them. So I have one in each arm and they're like big now, you know, they're not two little infants. Right. They're big.
We men are doing something women do all the time.
Right.
How do they carry this load? Right. Like, I don't know how they, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My wife's looking at me like, you realize this is what I'm doing all the time. Exactly. She's thinking about that.
No, your arms can't handle this.
As she listens to this podcast.
It's a whole different thing. Yeah.
She feels very validated that you just called me out.
For it's
that
like saying podcast. We were pregnant.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And you know, you just feel overwhelmed, but even to kind of like, as a dad, to go to the place of being like, oh, that's probably something of the desperation of what they're feeling and longing for is just, hey, will you touch me? Will you hold me? I feel extremely dysregulated. I'm all over the place. I can't make sense of this. Could you just like, could you touch me on the ribs? Could you put me on the shoulder? Could you make me, just because that's what I need.
Yes.
I think it, for me as a dad, as even just we're having this conversation, it makes me, I don't even feel a toxic shame of like, oh God, I can't believe I don't get pumped about holding them every single time. I feel just a sense of like deeper calling of being like, hey, I want to show up and be excited to hold you when you need to be held, because like, you're not asking for something unreasonable. Mm-hmm. You're actually asking for something that we all need.
Absolutely. And that recognition on your part is of course the number one thing, but also the number two part is if you don't refuel, you don't have fuel to fuel them.
Right.
I mean, and see, the farther and farther and farther away we get from kindergarten, from childhood, without taking that child with us, the less and less capable we are of, which we're going to touch base on and just say, attunement. I mean, it's just that it's crazy. You remember Matthew 18, 2 and 3. I think we've touched on it before.
Jesus talks about, Jesus puts a child,
has been tested. The disciples are going, how come, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Jesus takes a child and stands the child in front of him and says, unless you change and become like one of these. And we can't change ourselves. And that's the thing that we, as a whole audience of humans, we struggle with, that we do not change ourselves. We can change our habits, but we can't change ourselves. Right. We have to return to how we're made. We have to go home to how we're created. And he is literally confronting that right there with that audience. And it's still, he's still doing it today. Unless you change and become like one of these, hold me, be in need, be good at neediness, right? You can't enter the kingdom of heaven, which is have the life, as we're talking today, have the life you're made to have here on earth until you go home to ultimately how you're made. But both of these stories that we, you just told and I told, that this they leave legacy of memories that leave us vulnerable and could get us made fun of, but they're so valuable, they blessed our lives in ways that, you know, are amazing.
Right.
Amazing. Now, what happened though, what it does, what healthy touch does, it creates a situation called attunement. In other words, we're literally made to be regulated, called attunement, which is to be in tune or in rhythm with, or to be, my being is connected to the external world in a way that is symphonic, like the notes fit together.
Yeah.
Because that guy's tone of voice, hey, Chip, I mean, I don't even know if he called my name, but hey, you can do it. It was like looking into the face of a daddy, looking into the face of a helper who found a man in a ditch, like, you're no longer alone.
Yeah.
And then he touched me in the right way, the true way, that was left no questions.
Right.
Okay. And which is going to be important in a minute, but left no questions. And then attunement, like, oh, okay, I'm not alone. And now, remember, little children are not scared of death because they don't know what it is. They are scared of alone because we know what it is. We're born knowing the experience of it. And out of that experience of knowing we're not made to live with it, we start reaching for connection.
Yeah.
So attunement is number one. If you don't have a self that refuels, that knows your own limits, you don't know to refuel so you can tune into your children's needs. And then when you attune, what happens is an experience occurs called connection. All right. And connection, we've talked about, neuroscience tells us, and life itself has been telling us forever and ever and ever and ever, that we come out of the womb looking for who's looking for us, which is begging for affinity, which is naturally drawn to be together around the fire, so to speak, versus where there's no fire, there's no light. Where there's no light, there's dark.
Yeah.
So we're made for affinity, to be drawn together to go defeat the dark afterwards, okay? So attunement and connection. And connection fuels us to go attend to life's tragedies. It gives us strength. So attunement and connection, you hold the child. Then what happens next is, out of that connection, you don't increase your dependency. It doesn't make you a baby. It sets you free to go take risks. So by being fueled, you actually become autonomous. You become somebody who will make decisions, take risks, go fail, knowing that failure is one of the quotients of life, but you have a place to go with your failure to come back and learn some more, because we learn how to live through mistakes more than we learn how to live through just victories. Okay.
Right.
So now we've got attunement, to be tuned in, to receive tuning back, like to have, hey, I remember sitting out back on the balcony one time, and one of these evening bugs, those started with it, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, it's by itself. And then when another one heard it, it went, and all of a sudden I've got a cacophony, a symphony of their tuning in. And I heard music and it was just, and they all just got together and just absolutely played a symphony.
Yeah.
Right. Tunement, tuned in. Attunement, connection, autonomy. It sets us free to take risks because we have a place to go back to be refueled. It's called home.
Yeah.
Right. And if you have home, you actually end up having no trauma. You have horrible things happen, difficult things happen, but you have a healing process available to you. So attunement, connection, autonomy. And out of autonomy, we end up developing one of the strongest characteristics that is in great need of today, tomorrow, and yesterday, called trust. We develop trust, which is the ability to have a need and go get the need met in ways that attune, connect, and set me free again. So that's what touch is for. It's it's attunement, connection, and autonomy, and trust. Now, autonomy then, okay, good touch doesn't necessarily leave us with many questions, except maybe, can I come back? Do you approve of me? Do you love me? But it leaves room for questions to be asked. Does that make sense?
We'll elaborate on it more.
Okay,
what do you mean? Okay, so.
Good touch leaves room for me to ask questions and have needs.
Okay.
Leaves room. But the questions I need to ask are not related to, what are you doing? What are you doing this for? It's not fear-based. It's simply confirmation-based, okay? Good touch. I didn't need to ask him, what are you doing? I wasn't afraid. I was comforted, okay? So when we grow up in a world where authorities around us, because of power bases of people who can lord over another person, that drill instructor could have harmed you. Instead, he blessed you. So one of the first things that we leave behind when we leave kindergarten, we leave behind sensitivity to ourselves while we still have the same needs. In other words, we are taught to quit listening to our fear, quit listening to our sadness, quit listening to our hurt, quit listening to our loneliness, quit listening to our healthy shame, quit listening to our gladness even. We're taught to give up our feelings. But when you give up your feelings, you're giving up self-awareness, all right? Which means that somebody can touch you in a way that's inappropriate and not good touch. And if you don't have your feelings and the voice that goes with them, the voice of the heart, then you're not going to be able to take care of yourself. And tragically, with this incredible need to be touched, you can officially be truly harmed, leaving behind not a legacy that leaves me and you looking at each other and going, I want to remember this, even though it leaves me vulnerable and I could be made fun of, but that drill instructor saved me that day.
Yeah.
That coach saved a 14-year-old boy that day. And that legacy is so strong that one of the guys on that team became a very super tough guy, college football and significant military experience, like tough of the tough. And do you know what? He told me at the high school reunion, I have our photograph. He said, I have the photograph I cut out of my annual. I have it magnetized to my filing cabinet. And underneath it, I wrote, the greatest men I'll ever know. Now think about that, the meaning of those 14-year-old kids doing that. But if Gail Blair had not attuned, connected, set me free to take a risk, trusting, I wouldn't be in that photograph. I wouldn't have, with Johnny telling me that, I wouldn't have felt that sense of connection to something of our lifetime.
Yeah.
So this is big. So when you lose contact with your feelings, you no longer can trust your intuition. Okay. And you can't know to trust your suspicion. And therefore you wind up not asking questions about what's happening. Like, what are you doing? What do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm scared of that, or I don't like that, or anger. In other words, we lose boundaries because touch crosses a space between me and you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we think of that as a physical thing, reaching across. But people can reach across with their eyes, reach across with their voices. And if it is not wanted, not needed, you have to be sensitive enough to be able to say, what are you doing? What's this for? How come you're doing this? What are you offering me? In other words, there has to be a respect in the other who's making an offering to be noted, to be questioned, to be asked.
Yeah.
So a healthy relationship that has healthy touch in it, there's much freedom for questions to be asked, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because remember where we start is that touch is a communication that can often not have a language.
Mm.
And if we don't put language to it, it can wind up becoming what we know in this world today, horrific legacy of not wanting to remember things.
Right.
And not wanting to remember those people, because we can't forget our lives.
Mm-hmm.
We can suppress them.
Yeah.
We can repress them. We can rationalize. And all of those are forms of survival mechanisms that are about running from the heart, leaving us in disattunement, out of rhythm, disconnected, isolated, no longer autonomous, except we're independent from needing, but we're not truly autonomous because we don't have a home base.
Yeah.
And then we wind up not trusting.
Mm.
And that's a scary place to live.
Mm.
Okay. And now let's leave with the rooster.
Which is funny because I don't know if the mics are picking this up or not, but the rooster is back and it is crowing like crazy right now.
Yeah. And we leave with this, that to you, that rooster is a great memory of being in the football stadium.
Third down.
Being exactly. Continue to be loyal to a team that keeps losing. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Right? That's what I thought. I was like, is that the parallel to the Gamecocks? Is your team was not very good and my team was not very good?
You know, is that the analogy is you want to remember that crow calling, I mean, not crow, the rooster calling actually reminds you of something you want to hang on to.
Mm.
But that same rooster crowing can be something that somebody doesn't want to remember.
Yeah.
You know, so... And if it's something you don't want to remember, reality is we're never going to forget our lives, but we have to go deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so by not remembering won't heal you.
Right.
You have to feel it to heal it.
Mm.
And we become as sick as the memories we run away from.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I hate this. I hate to end on this, but we're made to be touched, and touch gets abused. Good touch blesses, bad touch we need healing from.
Yeah.
But remember that that getting your voice back, being able to ask questions related to your self-awareness is very important. And returning to sensitivity towards yourself and your story of your life and being able to tell the story of your life and let yourself be touched by telling that story by other people who know their own stories,
right?
You know, so.
Well, even if you don't want it, you know, I mean, I don't think that's a negative note. It's an honest note, but it doesn't make it bad. But I think one of the things I was thinking about, just even to make this super practical, one of the things, and part of this was the overflow of reading Needs of the Heart and seeing this chapter on touch and kind of waking up to, you know, it can create pain, but it is like a remarkable, almost superpower. You know, yes. In terms of like blessing other people, even if you think about those two stories we just told, but even just to make this super practical for me, one of the things I've practically started doing. So I used to, when I leave the house in the morning, I used to be like, love you guys. See ya. You know, And even I would be intentional enough to say, I would go person by person, like,
yeah,
love you, Meg, my wife. Mm. Love you, Hannah. Love you, Gracie. Love you, Bear. Love you, Ruthie. And I would wait for them to, you know, but they're all scattered around the yeah. house. Now I will, this morning I left before anybody was awake, but if people are awake, I will literally go person by person and I will put my hand on their shoulder. Yep. I will look them in the eyes mm-hmm. and I'll just say, hey, I love you. And I'll see you when I get home.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I'm like, oh, something more powerful is happening here than me just yelling from downstairs.
Absolutely. See you later. Absolutely. And I want as many people as possible, please get the Needs of the Heart book.
Mm-hmm.
And please get, also order the Companion Book Study, which is just a linear fill in the blank, few personal questions. That's very well done. I didn't do it, so I could say very, very
yeah,
well
that's done. Right.
But also, Needs of the Heart is a very significant book. But you just said it beautifully that touch, look at what it does. It offers us security. It tells us that we matter. It meets the need to belong. It speaks to the desires of the heart. It keeps us, it lets us know that we're cared about, and it expresses caring. So it's a vital experience.
Right.
So much so, I remember there's even an educational program called Workshop Way. You reminded me, the way you leave your children every morning is part of Workshop Way. Look them in the eyes, communicate with them, and that touch, without mm-hmm. touching, communicates value.
Right.
And I remember Sonia, before our first child was born, literally, I remember she had this book called Your Child's Self-Esteem, which is about touching your child. In other words, staying in heart with your mm-hmm. child, attunement, connection, autonomy, and trust. And that book was dog-eared, coffee-stained, folded over, yellowed pages, a crumpled cover that she poured over it in a begging prayer to please, Lord, you know, mm-hmm. let me step into meeting the needs of my child's craving to be touched
mm.
and to have their needs met, mm-hmm. to know a place called home so they can go out into the world, ultimately leave me
yeah.
and meet the world's needs with their gifts. So,
mm.
yeah, great place. Let's close there.
Okay.
It's a good place.
We got spirit, and I know you hear it. There's no give up, give up, give up, give up in us.